Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Well, it's been great to be here and getting to know many of you. You know about podiums, they're always at a slant, so you can't put your water bottle on it. Yeah, just kneel here and I'll put it on your back. All right. So, this afternoon, what's my when does the trap door drop and make me fall through at the end? Is it
2:15?
2:15. Good, 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 good. I'll give you more time for questions this time. So, as I said, it's the Christian and creation. So, the first talk was on our responsibility to the creation, the dominion mandate, and what does that look like? I'd love to have more fireside chat on that as far as pushing things out into the corners and how do we apply that in real world situations. We just touched on that a little bit in the Q&A, but we can go a lot farther. This talk and tomorrow will be, you know, the fact that God created, but he didn't just say that he did create in the scriptures. He tells us a little bit about when he created, the nature of his creation. So we're going to look at that and contrast that with the theory of evolution. Okay, so creation according to science. Okay, and we can call this, you know how you have two different aspects of knowing. You've got the general revelation and what? Special. So the scripture is going to be special revelation. This is general revelation or natural revelation. So it's a vast subject with lots and lots of different topics. But what I decided to do was just pick what I thought were the most salient issues in the controversy that I wanted to hammer home in a way that I think is accessible to any lay person out there. So I don't want to get really technical at all. There's no point to that. But I do want to hit the main things about biblical creation and things that often come up. So the questions that I'm going to address this afternoon are The questions I want to address are microevolution or macroevolution, which is fact and which is fiction. Are fossils best explained by uniformitarianism or catastrophism? We'll define those terms clearly, those concepts. Do transitional forms between animal groups exist? Plant groups, for that matter. And can we trust radiometric dating? That always seems to come up. So let's look at the first one. And I'm going to look at the difference between micro and macro. Some creationists like to steer away from these terms because it can cause too much confusion. There's only one letter difference. Micro and macro evolution, very, very close in spelling, but worlds apart in their definitions. Okay, so let's look at that. Microevolution is just, you know, some people think evolution is a bad word, but no, it just means change. It just means change. So microevolution is you could say that it is how they define it in biology class is a change in gene frequencies in a population over time. What does that mean? You know, it's basically any time a population of animals or plants changes in any amount of time in terms of the overall profile of that population, they would call that evolution. Now, we hear a lot about natural selection, and natural selection is not a dirty word, okay? It was actually coined by a creationist, Edward Blythe, because he knew in even domestic animals, when hard winters would cull the herd, That was natural selection. It wasn't artificial selection where you're picking which animals to breed. It was nature applying a lot of pressure and weeding out the weak individuals. So that's natural selection. The process by which individuals of lower fitness in every generation are eliminated by eliminated from the population. So just a case in point, they make a lot of... Peter and Rosemary Grant had done decades worth of research on the Galapagos Islands with many of the finches there, but this is called the medium ground finch. And they measured lots of things, but one of the things they measured was beak depth. And they had to do a really long-term study, and they noticed that as they measured these beaks, you would get an average beak depth. And the beak, of course, is the finch's cutlery. It's how they eat. It's their nutcracker. It's their seed opener. And when they had a drought, this is over the 1977, 1980, 1982, and on this, and the y-axis was millimeters of rain. So on a real dry year, I'm sorry, not millimeters of rain. This is beak depth. That's the measurement of the depth. But on a dry year, the beak depth got bigger. Why?
So they have a bigger mouth to crack food.
Good.
Bigger all the smaller food.
Right. So the bigger beak was a better nutcracker. And all the small seeds would be eaten up because there's a drought and none was available. And only the hardest nuts were available. And the ones with the smaller beaks couldn't crack those heavy nuts. And so the ones that had a little bit bigger beaks could crack the nuts and could get enough energy to survive and nest and breed. So they passed on their big beak genes to their next the offspring. And so the next generation would have big beaks. So that was just a nice case in point of natural selection. But it's interesting to note that when it was a wet year, the beak average beak depth would go down. And then after another drought, the beak depth would go up. Not much. The beak depth would go up maybe a half a millimeter. Half a millimeter, half the thickness of a dime. And that was sometimes the difference between life and death. Dry year, back down. Dry year, beak. Wet year, way down. So there was no, it was just oscillating, trying to track, it basically tracked the environment. That's microevolution. And at best, it involves the modification of traits that already exist. Finches have beaks. You can modify it to fit. Natural selection would kind of track the environment. The beak would track the environment. Now, I use an automotive example because people like cars. And what's this? It's a Model T. Good. Model T. And this is a Model T. A microevolutionary change would just be maybe a change in color. Change in hubcap color. You modified some features that Model Ts have. You didn't get anything more. Right? You say right.
Yeah.
Right. There's no addition other than a change in paint, but it's still paint. It's still, there's no anti-lock brakes. There are no driver's side airbags. No kind of these modifications that are random can change things other than modification. Does that make sense? You modify what exists. So if you got feathers, you can modify them. You got skin color, you can modify skin color. You can modify hair texture, hair color, height. Some people are short, some people are tall. Some people have wide faces. Some people have narrow faces, right? It's kind of like finch beaks. All right? All of those are subject to modification. That's fact, and we can see it in the lab and in the field all the time. Macroevolution, however, is fiction. Because when you go from... If you go from... Oh, my goodness. You go from a Model T to the Batmobile, we've got some problems. Now, obviously, we went from the Model T to the Batmobile. Why? There are these people called what? Automotive engineers that, like, I know what we can do. We can keep adding stuff. Now, we've got your normal cars on the road that have got way more stuff than a Model T, but the Batmobile's got way more stuff than our cars, right? They've got cannons and bat pods where everything blows away and you've got a motorcycle in the middle of it that rides away. You've got all sorts of gizmos that have to be written up in code by automotive engineers, and then they have to manufacture them and test them for safety and all of that. Notice the difference, modification versus addition. Addition is the Achilles heel of evolution. Every example they parade before the watching public always involves modification. The addition, they sometimes say it's addition, but it's not. They are being deceptive because the stuff is already in the genes. It's just not turned on. It's in the genes and it pops up, kind of like a Swiss Army knife. It's like when I have a Swiss Army knife and I just have the blade out, and then you think it's a pocket knife, right? And then I put the blade in and I pull out a corkscrew. Evolution! That's not evolution. It's in there already. It's already designed in the knife. It's built in. And when it pops out and you see it, you go, oh, a new thing. No, it's not a new thing. It's an old thing that was hiding. Does that make sense? Thank you. And that they really take macro and micro. They often drop the prefixes off to blur the distinction between micro and macro. They just say, oh, macro is just a lot of micro. A little bit of change, a little bit of time, right? A little bit of change, a little bit of time. What's the corollary? A lot of change and a lot of time. So they get you to believe in a lot of time, then you say a lot of change. No, I don't care if you give it hundreds of millions of years, you do not get addition. Okay, you don't. There's no way genetically, unless you got somebody writing the software. In this case, somebody writing the genetic software. This is my example. That's an automotive example. This is a real example, biological example. If you go from something that's a pre-dinosaur lizard, that according to evolution, that's Hylonomus, it's kind of a lizard-like reptile, you have to add something to become a turtle, right? It's called a shell. And a shell is not just a hardening of the skin. It is architecturally fantastic. And if you look at the gene regulation on how a shell develops and the symmetry and how it works with a skeleton and the fact that you have your shoulder girdle, your pectoral, your clavicle and scapula inside the rib cage of a turtle, everything else has got the shoulder blade and clavicle outside the rib cage. All of the other vertebrates have it outside the rib cage. Turtles have theirs inside the rib cage. Same with the pelvic girdle. So you've got to have all sorts of amazing design features that have to be integrated with the shell, the plastron on the belly and the top shell called the carapace. That does not just happen. You can't just mutate DNA, notwithstanding Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You can't just mutate DNA and get shells. I don't care how much time you give it. So next, I'm switching gears to the next thing. Are fossils best explained by uniformitarianism or catastrophism? Now, if you saw is Genesis history, how many saw Genesis history? Okay. Good to watch. But you get a little bit of this in Genesis history. Mount St. Helens. A lot of things can happen in a very short time, and it looks like it's really old. Okay? Uniformitarianism is a concept that was developed back in the late 1700s by James Hutton and then picked up by Charles Lyell. And it's the belief that rocks, fossils, and formations were formed slowly over vast eons of time by slow-working processes that work today. Formed slowly, that's the key thing. So James Hutton was getting away from special revelation. He was saying science is now, we don't have to be studying the natural world through the lens of Scripture. We can just study the natural world and just make up our own assumptions as we go. And before James Hutton, it was flood geology, that the Noah's flood was responsible for all the sedimentary rock and dinosaur fossils and stuff like that. And he's basically saying, no, the present, this is how you summarize it, the present is the key to the past. So if sedimentation happens in millimeters, you know, millimeters per year, say in a river delta, so sediment, sand, silt, mud settles out and it's like millimeters per year sedimentation rate. That is the rate you go with, and you extrapolate back in time. And so if you've got something like the Grand Canyon, you assume that it took millions of years to stack up. Millions of years to stack up. Well, even millimeters per year, it would stack up faster than that. But that is the idea of uniformitarianism. Everything has to happen at a constant rate, and that basically, way before Darwin, this was 50 years before Darwin. They got the church to believe in uniformitarianism. So the church had already sold the farm and said, okay, the earth isn't young like the Bible says. We got to go with what the science says. So the church capitulated to this idea of uniformitarianism and totally accepted this idea of millions of years way before Darwin. Well, 50 years. Uniformitarianism, Charles Lyell really popularized it right before Darwin headed off on his HMS Beagle voyage. Darwin took principles of geology, which really, really, really pushed this concept of uniformitarianism. Catastrophism, on the other hand, is rocks, fossils, and formations were formed rapidly due to catastrophic events in a relatively short period of time. In other words, the Noah's flood can drag up and erode massive amounts of sediment and rock and sand and pile it up really deep in a global flood. It doesn't necessarily mean Noah's flood. It just means we can explain this formation rapidly. Like Mount St. Helens. We've got this 1/40th scale canyon on one of the slopes of Mount St. Helens that formed in a matter of, well, the sediment formed quickly, and then the canyon was carved in a matter of weeks. You can get things that look like massive geologic structures like that in a matter of years, just a few years. Okay, so That's the two different ways of thinking and approaching the data. So, are fossils best explained by this? Which one? Well, fossils in sedimentary rock are best explained by catastrophism. I mean, this is a no-brainer. And actually, the secular geologists are coming around to this. The secular geologists, well, here. Let's say you're driving down a road and you see a dead raccoon in the middle of the road. And it's a traffic hazard. So you pull over and you grab the raccoon's tail and heave this dead raccoon into a muddy stream by the road in the ditch. Will that raccoon, it's muddy, right? Lots of muddy water. Will that raccoon become a fossil? Absolutely not. Even if it gets covered over with silt or sand, it will not become a fossil because a whole host of scavengers are going to pile on, and fungi, bacteria, all sorts of worms, aquatic insects, crayfish are going to pile on and eat that thing down to nothing in a matter of months. No fossil. So how do you get these big dinosaur graveyards? By a dinosaur falling down and getting buried slowly over millions of years? It wouldn't become a fossil. In fact, when you see the Grand Canyon and every layer is chock full of fossils, they shouldn't be there. If uniformitarianism is right, none of the fossils should be there. Just should be sedimentary rock all the way up. No fossils. If it's piling up at millimeters per year, everything would be scavenged. Everything would be wiped out. So just fossils tell you it had to have been buried quickly and it had to be buried super rapidly. Rapidly and deep. Not just quick, because the raccoon was buried quickly, but it was buried a little bit. You have to bury it super deep and super fast in order for it to fossilize, okay, and to keep it. The other thing is that soft tissue, a lot of them are not even fossilized, as you saw in its Genesis history. Shook the world up when Mary Schweitzer broke open a T-Rex femur, brought it back to the lab because it looked curiously unfossilized, and they dissolved the bone away, the bone calcium carbonate away from the bone with a weak acid, so the calcium hardness was leached away, and you had soft dinosaur tissue. It was stretchy. It had blood vessels in it. It had blood cells. It had bone cells, and it was stretchy. It had collagen. It was dinosaur tissue. It was not fossilized. It was the dinosaur's bone. It was the actual bone. This is actually some T-Rex soft tissue. Looks like something you could be in your garbage can after a nice meaty dinner. Okay? That is T-Rex soft tissue. Stretchy. Both of these things. Now, there's a lot of people that are like trying to explain how this could survive for millions of years. Soft tissue can't survive millions of years. Even if you shut it away in perfect conditions, it's not going to last that long. Even if you lock it away from scavengers, lock it away from fungi and anything that could be a decomposer, if you lock it away and you preserve it in cold rock, it might last, based on decay, thermal decay, it might last maybe 900,000 years in prime conditions. But when you're talking about Wyoming and Montana rock formations, it's not good conditions. It's going to go from hot rock to cold rock. You know, winter, super cold, super hot, super cold, super hot. That is murder, just on biological molecules. proteins can't last that long when you're going hot and cold, hot and cold, hot and cold. And you're thinking, I only thought scavengers could take it away. No, no, no. Thermal energy, room temperature will cause it to go away. Even if you sterilize something and there's no microbes at all, it can't last for a long time. It's physics. It's physics. So these two things, this catastrophism, you shouldn't have fossils, and you certainly shouldn't have soft tissue if it's old. Now, I'm going to switch gears to another thing that I love. When I was teaching biology at Liberty, we used a secular textbook, and I turned the page, and of course, it had an evolutionary tree of mammals. But one thing I liked about this evolutionary tree was that it was at least somewhat honest about the fossils. This is the mammal evolutionary tree. I want you to pay attention here. Do transitional forms between animal groups exist? Okay, so what they have here are mammal orders. Orders are big categories, like marsupials. Marsupials are like kangaroos, wombats, Tasmanian devils, quolls, stuff I just saw last month down there in Australia. And that's marsupial fossils all the way back in time or through the geologic strata. Now, I don't believe in the time scale here. This would be back to 65 million years, but I would say that most of these things were buried either in the flood sediments or after the flood. So marsupials, rabbits, that's lagomorphs. Rodents is the biggest order. Rodents go from beavers to mice. What are some other rodents? Beaver, rats, mice. Nope. Squirrels? What? Nope. What? Yeah, capybaras are rodents. They're big rodents. Beavers are big rodents. Gerbils are rodents. Hamsters are rodents. What? Mountain beaver, yes. That's a different family than the regular beaver. All of those are rodents. Prairie dogs are rodents. Marmots are rodents. Ground squirrels are rodents. All of those are rodents. That's the biggest order. Elephants. Fossil record of elephants, whales, even toad-hoofed animals, mammals like deer, all the deer, pig, antelope and gazelles and stuff like that, and so on, bats. Now, what is interesting about this evolutionary tree is the gray vertical bars are the fossil record. How do they have, what do the evolutionists have to do to make them related? What are those things called down here? It's called dotted lines. You know what dotted lines are? In this, dotted lines means no fossils. What are you talking about? This is a secular textbook, and they're drawing a tree that has no trunk. Here's the trunk of the mammalian tree. Then you have something down here that's some extinct mammal. I love the platypus here. Bonk. To question mark. You don't have an evolutionary tree. You have a forest. And each major group is a separate chunk of fossils. But evolution is so taught that often in high school textbooks, they don't do the dotted lines. You know what they do in most high school textbooks? They don't do dotted lines. They just connect them. As if it's all just mapped out and they've got all the transitional forms figured out. And you might say, wait a minute. Does this mean that rodents are all related? Beavers, mountain beavers, ground squirrels, swine squirrels, gerbils, hamsters? No. Let's zoom in on rodents. Let's zoom in on the fossil record of just rodents. Do you see dotted lines? Yes. Each one of these groups, I just have more familiar ones. Spring hare, mole, naked mole rats, chinchillas, that's another rodent. Squirrels and chipmunks, beavers, rats and mice, those are all representatives of different families of rodents. And you got fossil records of each family, but then if you want to connect them, you got to put dotted lines in, because dotted lines don't exist. You should just white out all the dotted lines. And then, you know what your chart would say? God created all of the different, kind of like Genesis 1. God created the various kinds. That's what the fossil record says if you white out the dotted lines, which you should do. Can't we trust radiometric dating? No. My book has a chapter on it. It's called Blind Dating. I like that type. Chapter, Blind Dating. I'm not going to go into great detail here, but hang on, because a lot of people ask about it, but you have to think a little bit, just a little bit. So I want you to think a little bit here. You hear about radiometric dating, and usually people don't say radiometric dating, they say carbon dating. Why? Because it's easier to say. And carbon dating is just one of many radiometric dating techniques. But all of the techniques have certain assumptions, and this is showing, the chart here is showing how half-life works. Half-life, if you've got a radiometric, if you've got a radioactive substance like uranium-238 or potassium-40, if we have a sample here and this orange circle represents potassium-40, and that's radioactive, and it emits beta particles and so on. But after you wait, based on the rate of how it emits radioactivity, it slowly decays into argon-40. Potassium decays into another noble element, noble gas called argon. So, but it takes about 1.25 billion years, based on the rate of decay, 1.25 billion years for half of it to become argon. You have to wait another, so this is 1.25 billion years, right there, one half-life, which is 1.25 billion or 1,251 million years, for half of that sample to decay into daughter. So the radioactive stuff is parent, and the parent decays into daughter. One half-life, you've lost half of your sample to daughter. You have to wait another half-life, and then in that second half-life, then the half of the remaining decays. So it's always half of a half. So first, all, half, quarter, eighth, sixteenth. But in between each one, it's a half-life, 1.25 billion years. It's not like an hourglass. Hourglass, you do one half, and then the next half-life, all of it's done. So in this radio stuff, it's an exponential decay where it's always half of the remaining decays, and then the next half-life, half of the remainder decays, and always half of a half. Okay, does that, so it's, you could do it with a pie. You take an apple pie, one half-life, toss half the pie away. The next half-life, take a quarter away. Next half-life, take an eighth away until you're left with a very, very skinny piece. And the half-lives change for each group in uranium to lead, it's like 4.5 billion year half-life. This one, potassium to argon, is 1.25 billion years half-life. Carbon-14 is very quick. Carbon-14 decays into nitrogen-14 in only 5,731 years. That's a very fast half-life. So in carbon, they never date dinosaur bones with carbon dating. Because why? They think dinosaurs are at least 65 million years old. Carbon-14 has half-lives that are so short that after that many half-lives, there's going to be no carbon-14 left. So in carbon dating, they never date anything that they think's over 50,000 years old. If they think it's over 50,000 years old, they don't date it with carbon-14. They only do it for archaeological digs, biblical archaeology, Egypt, all of that, because they think it's in the thousands of years. And so they'll do carbon-14, but they never used carbon-14 for dinosaurs. They say it's too old. However, the assumptions used that they in this is that the system is closed. In other words, during the decay process, nothing enters the rock or leaves the rock. So no false parent, no false daughter goes in or out. It's closed, kind of like an hourglass. You can't add sand to the upper bin or the lower bin or subtract sand from the upper bin or lower bin because that'll throw your time off, right? So you assume it's closed system, and when you have a rock formation, it's not closed because there's water going through it. There's groundwater going through it. It's not closed. Ratio of parent to daughter is known at time zero. So, for example, if you say time zero, 100% parent, well, if that's right, then one half-life, half of it's gone. If we come up to a rock and it's half potassium and half argon, we would say, oh, this rock is 1.25 billion years old. Well, you're assuming that it started like that. What if it started like that? And God made the rock half argon, half potassium. We would wrongly assume it's super old. And it's not super old. Okay? And we also have to assume the decay rate remains constant. And that's not always the case. You say, well, I don't get all that stuff. That's fine. You don't have to get all that stuff. But this you will get. We can check it. We can check it with known rocks. One of the favorite ways to date igneous rock, is lava rock, is potassium argon. And time zero is when the lava cools. Because the idea is when it's hot and it's molten, all the argon blows off, and you're just left with, in terms of the ratio of potassium to argon, when it cools, it's all potassium. So you assume, okay, time zero. And then if you've got argon in it, you figure out based on your curve and doing your math that it's umpteen million years old. But we've got historical records of certain lava flows. So Holly, Hulalai basalt in Hawaii, 200 years ago, it was extruded. It turned into rock. That's time zero. They dated it at 1.6 million years old. I think that's a bit of an error, okay, because it's only 200 years old. And it's 1.6 million. Look at Kilauea. This is crazy. Kilauea in Hawaii. 200 years ago, they came up with 21 million year old rock. And it's only less than 200 years. 1,000 years old. Historical record. The lava flowed at 1,000 years ago. 42.9 million years old. It's less than 1,000. And they'll tell you, well, this is why there's error. But when they have a rock that they don't have historical record, guess what they do? They believe it. Look at this. You can't trust it. You are assuming, we know it's millions and millions of years off. This is the real date. This is the radiometric date. Why do we trust it? If we don't know this, why do we trust this? Because evolution, they've got to believe that evolution is a fact. But, so we're ending here. I want to summarize what I just went through. We hit different subjects. Microevolution produces modification and happens all the time. But it cannot produce macroevolutionary change involving addition. And I use the turtle example or Model T to Batmobile, but we know we wouldn't get a Batmobile if there was no automotive engineers. So macro, that just can't happen. Addition can't happen. Only modification. And if you've read Dr. John Sanford's book, Genetic Entropy, it actually, modification usually means loss of information. So slowly, inexorably, information content keeps going downhill. It never gets better. It's only getting worse. I know that's sort of depressing for a bunch of post-millennialists. But you look at the ages of Methuselah and Adam and Noah. Those guys lived really long, and now we're lucky if we make it to 90. We are just going downhill genetically. So modification is usually modify and loss. We wear out. I wrote a chapter on that. It's called Faded Genes. ha ha ha. You got to appreciate those chapter titles. Okay, so faded genes. Second, catastrophism explains fossils better than uniformitarianism, because uniformitarianism doesn't explain fossils very well at all. Lack of transitional fossils between large groups do not support common ancestry. I could show you all the groups. I did mammals and rodents, but I could look at amphibians, reptiles, insects, every group I've looked at, it's the same exact picture. Dotted lines, rule. Radiometric dating shouldn't be trusted. It is blind dating. All right, questions? Yes, sir.